Access number 12941, Wally Binch, Reel 3.
Mr. Binch, Reel 3. Where did you go next after Euston Ferry then?
Well, as far as I recall, from Euston Ferry, we went to guarding an RAF aerodrome, Waltham's, at Waltham. And the thing that struck us, what we were doing there was mainly guarding the aerodrome, preparing for invasion. We did lots of mock invasion drill, 3 o'clock in the morning, that sort of thing. Any aircraft that crashed, we were guarding those as well. I remember one of the things that struck me was the vastness of the place, seeing so many people after Alston Ferry. We were in a little village, and suddenly we're amongst all the Air Force, and we see fried eggs and things like that. And
how did you get on with the RAF? What did you think of them?
Well, we tolerated them, and they tolerated us. To us, they were the Brill Cream Boys, and we were the fighting soldiers. But
was there any actual trouble between you?
Not there, no. Not as far as I know. No, not really.
And you were there, that you'd gone there on June the 16th, roughly speaking, according to this list, and you were there until September the 30th, then you went to Brig. What about Brig?
Yes, well, at Brig, we went there to Brig, and at Brig we were introduced to the armadillos, which were armoured cars, and we all had turns in learning how to drive those.
Could you drive before?
No, I couldn't drive, yeah. I had no idea of driving. In fact, I believe it was at Brig where I saw a chance of getting out of route marches. They asked for volunteers for dispatch riding. Well, I'd never ridden a motorbike, but no, they asked for people who could ride motorbikes, that's right. So I said yes, and I went on the course, and the first day I remember the corporal was asking people to start the bikes up, and I was about last in line, and I was saying to a fellow, well, I've not ridden mine for a long while, how do you do it? I've forgotten. And eventually, by the time it came to my turn, I'd got a rough idea. Anyway, that was a week's course, as far as I know, and by the end of it, I was a dispatch rider.
What were your duties as a dispatch rider then? What exactly did you do?
Well, taking dispatches, of course. First thing is, of course, we had to learn how to maintain the bike, and we had these maintenance tasks. And
what sort of thing?
Well, number one was... What was number one? What was number one? Well, it was looking after the brakes and the engines and, first of all, the simple tasks. And then once a week was checking the oil, etc. And daily might have been checking the oil, yes. Once a week checking plugs, things like that. And then once a month testing other things, which I can't remember.
And where would you be taking dispatches to?
I was taking them round all around the airfields, around Waltham. I remember Binbrook, Manby. We had companies in all those places, so I was taking things all around there.
Around the company offices?
Around the company, yes, to company HQs. I think I told you before. That was it. Must have been sometime around this time when. I played truant. I took the motorbike back to Nottingham, to Northcote Terrace, and I was showing off to the kids. Roy Rogers was the cowboy, was all the rage at the time, and I was jumping on and off the bike, or trying to. What I'd forgotten was that when I jumped on the over the bike, the accelerator would turn, and the bike shot away from me and banged into a lamppost. And I remember my dad spent a long while trying to straighten the buckle wheel, and eventually I got back, and as far as I know, I got away with it.
You were enjoying riding a motorbike from the sound?
Yes, I loved it. Yes, it was great. Yes, great fun. Yes, yes, I enjoyed it. I had an Enfield, Royal Enfield, 350cc there at that time, yes.
Yeah. Was it reliable when you weren't banging it into lampposts?
Yes. I can't ever remember breaking down with it, so it must have been reliable, yes. Yes.
Would you ever drive trucks or the armadillos as well?
Well, in Brig, we had lessons on driving the armadillos, but as far as I know, all I had was the lesson on driving the armadillo. I don't ever remember taking it out anywhere. So we just had lessons on that. Possibly I might have volunteered for this other course, you see, the DR.
As a Donna, did you have anything to keep you warm?
Yeah, we had these leather, had the leather, I've got a photograph somewhere, leather jerkins, and also we had the crash helmet and the gauntlets. And that was about all we had at that stage, yes.
That's some more of the characters in the 70th Battalion were obviously appearing, you know.
Yes.
In, you know, you're getting to know people by now.
Yes.
Some of the people we haven't talked about. I mean, Spike Gamble, what do you remember about him?
Well, Fred Gamble, or Spike Gamble, a little lad from Bradford, and he was always in trouble, always against people, always on the charge, always on jankers. In fact, he formed the Black Hand Gang, this is called it. And there was trouble one day, and he, as leader of the Black Hand Gang, wanted everybody else to back him up, but nobody else would say anything, so Spike said his bit and got put in the charge for it. Probably some complaint. And also having a second little fight there with a fellow called Ron Smedley. We had a little scrap about something or other, and I won this one. And but we were the best of mates afterwards, of course. Now, Ron Smedley, I've been trying to contact ever since, but never seen that, another one I've never seen since, but there we are. And there was a Vic Newham was still in the picture, and he was still a private, but he got made up to a corporal later, but I'm not sure whether it was in the 70s or the 2nd 5th.
Were you still with Wally Preston, hanging around with him?
Wally Preston was still with us, but I can't remember much about,
He drifted apart a bit, had you, or made new friends, more friends?
Yeah, made new friends, actually, yes, rather than, I can't remember much about Wally Preston being involved in too many things after that. As I say, but I do recall Sergeant Rice, for instance, Hiram Rice, who was a real disciplinarian. And it wasn't until after the war, when I told my mother about Sergeant Rice, when she said, oh, Hiram, your cousin. I says, now you tell me, you know. So he turned out to be my cousin, but I didn't know that at the time. My mother's name being Rice, a maiden, you see, yeah. But he was a disciplinarian, but he was fair, you know, and off duty, he was quite pally with you. Yeah.
What about officers? Have they started to appear in your consciousness a bit more by now?
Not really. No, not in the 70s. I don't recall much of the officers at all in the 70s. So obviously, they're not made too much of an impression on me in the 70s.
Now, the next move was to Woodhall.
Woodhall Spa, yes.
Where's that?
That's in Lincolnshire again.
Most
and
of
it's
these
near, yeah, they're all near airfields, actually, yeah. And I know we went there, and I can remember we were training again in the fields. There was a place there called the Kinema in the Woods. And I have been recently, and it's still there today, you know. So that's a place that's a nice memory for all of us. And I remember that at the time, we did some training, then we all had leave, or most of us had leave, and I went home. It was Christmas time, and by this time, the girlfriend that I told you about, Betty Johnson, I'd obviously lost her, because I went back home after 3 days, went back rather to Woodhall Spa. I was thoroughly browned off, so I went back to the camp before my time was due. So that's how I remember that ties together that little sequence of events.
Now, in December, you were firing at Greycoats. Do you remember that? That must be your firing course.
Yes, all I know is about that is that we all went on it, so I know that I went on it as well. And we did firing tests, but beyond that, not much of a recollection. It was just one of those things that we did again. You know, we all had to do it, and we'll be happy as soon as they finish, you know.
So what was your next move then?
To best of my knowledge then, we went, after we came back off leave, All the companies went to different airfields, and we went to Hibblestow, which is an aerodrome. And I was a dispatch rider there and still going round all the companies.
So your routine didn't really change there?
No.
Anything special while you were there?
Nothing special happened at all there, no. In fact, the only significant thing that happened then was, for some reason or other, I was put in the MT office, and a form came through asking for volunteers to go abroad. So I put my name at the top to see so I must have been anxious to do a bit more. And then shortly afterwards, I was posted to the 2nd and 5th Battalion. And this would be round about, I think, about August 1942, something around there.
Now, what were your first impressions of the 2nd 5th when you joined them?
Well, we went there by train, and we were met by people with 1,500 weight Canadian Chevs. And my first impression was a horrible whining sound that this made as we sat in the back, and they seemed to speed us off, and we thought, my God, what are we going into now? What's going to happen to us? And then the next day, we meet all the battalion, or we see battalion members, and they all seem to be a lot older than us. But they weren't really, probably about 4 or 5 years. And then we were on route marches, etc.
About how many of you were in the draft from the 70s?
Weren't too many in this draft.
About?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I would think about a platoon strength, something like that, you know, about 20 or 30, as far as I remember.
And what company were you put into when you started?
The company, I don't know. I don't know what company I was put into. I know, all I can remember is whether they were trying to size us up, but they made us all go into a boxing ring, and we all had to go and fight somebody, you know. So that was my third fight. I was all right. I was successful in that one as well.
Did you do much? Had you done much boxing? Did you enjoy boxing?
Not really, no. The only boxing I did was as a lad before the army. Yeah, we did a bit of boxing training at a fella called Jackie Vans. We used to go in his little gymnasium underneath the shop, boxing and wrestling, sort of thing. Yeah.
And what did they make you welcome? They were older than you. Did you feel a bit out of place?
No, I don't think we felt out of place. We were full of ourselves, thinking, right, because everybody knew that eventually they were going abroad. We'd gone into it to be going abroad. Which makes me wonder if it wasn't slightly later than August, because we eventually went abroad in December. So it may have been a little later than August. It may have been slightly later. A call came then. We'd been in there some time, and they were, I think, just making up the anti-tank platoon, or they were asking for volunteers for the anti-tank platoon. And I'd met a fella just before we joined the anti-tank platoon called Eddie Hallett, and we met each other, and we clicked, and we became strong muckers straight away. And I found out that Eddie Hallett, who was from Somerset, he'd been in the concert party, so we had one or two things in common. And he had one or two songs that I'd never heard in my life, you know. The Enemy Old Cigar, and For Years a Fairy Queen I've Been, and songs like that. Songs which we were to use later, you know, when we came to entertain the lads.
What did Eddie play? Did he play anything? Or was he
no, Eddie was just a singer. Yeah, Eddie sang. A ginger-haired lad, you know, and full of life and full of little quips and that. And we sang together, and we seemed to harmonise well when we... Although I didn't really know what harmonising was at this stage, but we gradually learnt something. I suppose by playing the ukulele and knowing something about chords, what I learnt was if I didn't harmonise right, it didn't sound right, so I learned to harmonise the hard way. Yeah.
And how long was it before you started writing parodies with Eddie? Did you start while you were in England?
Yes, I think we did, because the first thing I remember was Eddie had been in this concert party, and they'd done a song called The Gendarmes. We'll run them in, And then Eddie and I, when we joined the Anti-Tank Platoon, we made our first parody, which was more or less... So it was more or less like this. Now we're the anti-tank lads, all the way from Anglerton, and we'll go through shells and mortars without a single care. And when we meet the enemy, who we call the Jerry Cads, we'll run them in, we'll show them we're the anti-tank lads. We'll run them in, we'll show them we're the anti-tank lads. And we did about three choruses of that, you know, all words saying how good the anti-tank platoon was. And that was our first joint effort.
Yeah. And you started playing, you just played to the rest of the lads in the anti-tank platoon. Would you play any wider at that stage?
No, not at that stage, just about to the local lads or in the nappy sort of thing. And then...
Now, you joined the anti-tank platoon. What weapons did they have at the time?
At the time, there were the two-pounder anti-tank guns that... And they were pulled by what they called Portees, which was a lorry. And that was in England. And I know there was an accident by somebody, one overturned. We would also have route marchers.
You know. No, hang on. Sticking with the things.
Yes.
What was your job? You joined the anti-tank. Were you still a... Would you be the Donar? Or were you leaving your Donar?
Yeah, I'd finished being a Donar by then, yes.
So what was your job within the anti-tank platoon?
Well, I was either number two or number three. You had to learn to do...
You were actually a gunner then?
Yes.
And how many were there on the gun?
Let's see. One corporal, and then there'd be four. So
the corporal would be the number one?
Well, the corporal would be in charge, and then there'd be heavy heads was on our gun. Heavy heads was number one. Stanwyde or myself was number two.
And then the number two did what?
Loading. And then there was a number three and four. I just can't remember the exact duties of that. But on our gun, there was Heavy Edwards, Stanwyde, Eddie Hallett and Wally Binch, and Corporal Jukes was in command of the gun commander. So there would be five of us.
And the number one, who would do the actual aiming?
The number one, Heavy Edwards...
And would you all get the chance to have a go at?
Yes. Oh, we all had to, so that if one got knocked out, we'd all anybody could fire or anybody could load. We did all those, and manhandling the gun and that was our work. You know, pushing the gun about, and we just have to fix the wheels off. And we had competitions between the sections to see who could do it the fastest and that sort of thing. A lot of friendly rivalry. Yeah. And our officer was Captain Johnny Walker, Captain J.M. Walker.
And did you get the chance to fire it much?
Yeah, we did firing.
Whereabouts?
We went on Camber Sands to do the firing. And
firing into the sea?
There was some firing into sea, but I also think we shot at targets as they crossed us. Because there was one incident which George Dean tells me about, who was in the platoon, and Corporal Percy Capewell was towing the target, and George Dean was firing, supposedly, at the target, but he was aiming at Percy Capewell, but being a bad shot, he missed him, luckily. So he tells that story today, right?
But you didn't see that, or you don't
remember? I didn't see that. No, George has told me about that many a time, yeah.
Now, did you take to loading? I mean, was it a difficult job?
No, we did all the things. It just came by training. We could do it all. No, there's nothing more difficult than anything else.
Were there any special tactics you had to learn as an anti-tank platoon? You know, how to deploy in action or things that you had to try and do?
Well, regarding the deployment of the guns, that was usually the task of the platoon commander, which was Lieutenant, not Captain, Lieutenant Johnny Walker. And usually the ranges were, it was supposed to be at its best effective range at about 200 yards. So
is that all?
The best, that was supposed to be the best effective range.
What was its longest range then? I mean, what would it be worth opening fire at all?
Well, I'd have thought about 1,000 yards, yeah.
But was the thing that it wouldn't penetrate armour?
Well, they did tell us all about the high velocity of and all that sort of thing, because we never got a chance really to try it against any real thick armour, you know, although tests were done. And of course, they wouldn't say anything to make us nervous about the gun. So, as far as they were concerned, but having read since that
it wasn't used much. I mean, the gun was replaced. I think you had them replaced as well.
Yeah, we had 6 pounders later. Yes.
What did you? I mean, did you think it was all right at the time when you were training with it?
Yes. Oh, yes, we did. Yes. I was quite confident that we, you know, whatever we did, you know. Yeah, we'd got full confidence in it. We didn't go into action eventually thinking, oh Christ, we haven't got the gun, we haven't got the tools to do the job. We didn't think that at all, no. Not once. No.
Now, the vehicle at where would you be when you were being towed, and where would you be?
We would be in the portee ourselves, and it would be towing the gun behind us.
At the back of it?
At the back of the portee, which was covered by a canvas hood, the portee would be. Which was a lorry with a canvas hood on the back towing the gun.
And would you practice a sort of crash action routine, you know, getting into action?
Oh, yes, yes, we did all that, yes. As I say, there was rivalry between the people to see who could do it in the best time, sort of thing. And after the portees, we hadn't had them long before we were issued with what's called Cordon Lloyds. And these Cordon Lloyds were track vehicles. But unlike the Bren gun, they didn't have a steering wheel. They had handles which locked one track or the other track, you know.
And how did they compare to the portees? I mean, what did the troop think of them?
Well, being troops, we just got on with the job and didn't question anything, sort of thing. So, but
so they were all right as far as...
Yeah, no problem. These also had a hood over them as well. And...
Now, you'd be in the headquarters company.
That's right, yes.
Presumably, if you're
in the anti-tank platoon, yes.
And you were at Hawkhurst, but where were you actually billeted? We hadn't covered that.
No. Well, I don't recall... We were in buildings of some kind, and I don't recall being in tents or anything like that, so...
You weren't in barracks, though?
No, we weren't in barracks, but... and I can't honestly recall whether we were in Nissen huts or buildings, but... One or the other, but we definitely weren't in tents and we weren't in barracks, yes.
Were there any particular characters you remember in the battalion or in headquarters company?
Well, or in our platoon, yes. As I say, Heavy Edwards, he'd been at Dunkirk and he was a real big fella, which is why we called him Heavy. He was also a bit bulshy, and Lieutenant Walker, who was quite a bit older than us. Lieutenant Walker was a coal merchant from Nottingham, and but we thought he was a great guy. A bit strict, but if we'd gone the route march, he would pull up at a cafe and buy the whole lot of us tea and wads, things like that. And later on, he was to be even more kind when we got abroad. But anyway, but Heavy Edwards was always a bit bolshy. And when Johnny Walker said that we were going to be going abroad very shortly, Heavy Edwards says, "Ah, it's all right for you, bloody officers." And Johnny Walker says, "Look, when we get over there, we shall all be the same." Says, "I shall even shit at the side of you." So after that, it became a platoon joke that Johnny Walker and Heavy Edwards had got their own toilet arrangements.
What about any other preparations for going overseas that you remember as the time came closer?
I can't remember.
Did you get any more injections at that point?
Yes, oh yes, we did, yes, yeah. We got all the injections, and before we went on embarkation leave, we were inspected by the King. I was rather surprised to see that. I thought the King had got makeup on. I was rather surprised. It looked as though his face was very heavily powdered, and we looked at each other and thought, well, he's got bloody makeup on.
Was that important to you, being inspected by the King, or were you, I mean, were you bothered by things like that?
We were very proud to be inspected by the King, yes. Yes, we were, yeah. and we knew that, you know, something was going to happen then. And we were full of, we wanted to do our bit for the country. That's what we'd come in the army for, yeah. And we were happy about that, yeah.
What about your embarkation leave? What did you do?
Well, then, so we had some embarkation leave and we lived it up. And the thing I remember about embarkation leave is when my mother came to the middle of the station and saw me off and said, well, don't come back with an arm missing. I thought, oh, dear. Typical. My dad throwing stones at me. And then my mother saying, don't come back with an arm missing.
What did your dad say when he knew you were actually going overseas?
Well, I think he was secretly proud of me, but in our family we don't say much, you know, so, he just said, you know, be careful and all that sort of thing.
Now, what about the actual leaving of Hawkhurst? What do you remember?
Leaving of Hawkhurst. Well, we left from there and we went to Aldershot. And it was in this room here. We were preparing, getting the last minute things before we went on embarkation leave. And once again, I was strutting around the room saying things like, wait till we get over there, we'll sort them Germans out. And Heavy Edwards, I always remember, picked up a shovel and said, listen, when we get over there, if you start crying for your mother, I'll hit you with this bloody shovel. Now, I've remembered that. I shall never forget that. And strangely enough, when we went to see Heavy Edwards after the war, Eddie Allen and I, and my missus were with us, we banged on the door and we said, do you think, we were still frightened of him, because we said, do you think he'll be all right? Will he say anything to us? But when he saw us, he was as pleased as punch, you know. But that's another story again.
So you were leaving. You went to Aldershot first then?
Went to Aldershot, yes. And then we went on leave. And then we, as far as I remember, then we went from there by train. That's right, went by train because the train stopped at the Midland station for about half an hour. And I thought, gosh, I'm only 5 minutes away from home. Dear, no. I was very, very tempted to leave the train, nip home and say, we're on our way, but we didn't. And we went to Liverpool, and I do remember that we went on, would it be trams? It would be trams, I think. On trams. And I thought, well, this is supposed to be secret. And everybody was wishing us good luck, lads, and that sort of thing. And then we got on the boat, I believe, on December the 23rd or 24th. I know we were on the boat on Christmas Eve, definitely.
Do you know which boat it was?
Yes, the Derbyshire. It was called the Derbyshire, yes. And we set sail on Christmas Day.
How did you feel about that?
Well, sad to see England go away, but looking forward to some excitement over there, you know, to getting into it. We wanted to get in the war, and we were pleased we were going.
Now, what were the conditions like on the Derbyshire?
Well, it seemed to be very, very overcrowded. Some of us had bunks. Some of us had hammocks. Not bunks, hammocks. Some slept on the tables. Some slept on the floors. There seemed to be a lot of smell and everything.
Everybody
was seasick.
What did you do?
I had a hammock, yeah. Well,
how did you manage with a hammock? Cause some
people very poorly. Eventually, I managed to sleep in the hammock, yes. Eventually, yeah.
What was difficult about it then?
Well, every time you got in it, you fell out of it, you see. It was getting in. Once you'd got in it, if you could lay still, you were okay. But, and we had lots of...
Were people seasick?
Yes, including myself, yeah.
Did you get it badly?
I think for about 2 or 3 days, yes, yeah. I think most of us were seasick at the beginning. And the thing I remember about being seasick, I smoked cigarettes then, by the way, which I'd learnt to smoke at Brig. I'd forced myself to smoke because everybody else did. I remember laying on my bunk and saying, come on, and the room was going round, but I was determined to smoke and be in fashion. But when I was seasick on the Derbyshire, the cigarettes seemed to taste awful, so I couldn't smoke anymore for a while. We were all issued with full-strength players, cigarettes, 50 tins of them. But they've got lots of saltpeter in them, somehow. I remember there was one tune that was being played on the ship's radio all the time. It was Tangerine. Tangerine, da, la 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 la. So that song always brings back the Derbyshire to me. Yeah.